Hello, guys and girls. The program you are about to hear will be both fun and educational, but it is not a substitute for medical advice. Although we are doctors, we are not your doctors. Hello and welcome to Travel Medicine. As always, I'm your friendly neighborhood internal medicine doc, Dr. J.
Heyo, Dr. Santosh here, your amazing pediatric.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Infectious disease doc and a researcher.
And we were just perusing some of the more cheerful poetry written by everybody's favorite laugh-a-minute author, Victor Hugo.
Yeah.
Well known for such cheerful and uplifting works as The Hunchback of Notre Dame and The Miserables.
So Les Miserables is, it's actually supposed to be more like The Piteous Ones, which is not too far away from The Miserable Ones. But yeah, he was not a huge comedic writer. There was a lot of, but yeah, ladies and gents, just now before you joined all of us, I got to introduce Dr. Josh to the poetry of Victor Hugo, which he hadn't been introduced to before. So I was happy to open his mind to a whole new world of melancholy and pain.
Victor Hugo's so emo, and it totally derailed our episode intro.
It has nothing. I don't know how. I mean, you'll find a way to segue in, I'm sure. But these were downers. They were really, really bad lines of sad adolescent kind of putrid poetry that you
okay, but yeah, but what if I read a little bit of a Victor Hugo poem,
okay,
after taking a hit off this balloon?
For this episode, do you have one of those balloons next to you?
This one is called The Man Who Laughed.
The end you will howl, wretch, still panting from your heinous crime.
yeah, you took in a lungful of a lighter than air gas, Josh.
So here's the segue. It does connect, because we're going to be talking about how an element that was discovered in the middle of a war in a kind of a diss track way has worked its way through to child's entertainment, important imaging, dangerous supplies running low, all the way back to the point where we're actually literally taking things away from children again. So it's exactly the sort of cheerful stuff that Victor Hugo would like.
Oh, sure. And I guess that we are, I mean, we're going to start with a war that's actually in Paris. So I guess we are going to be hanging out, you know, in and around where Victor Hugo liked to hang out.
With Les Misérables.
It's really tough to say. If you're not a native French speaker, Les Misérables is a tough. Yeah.
So on today's episode, for those of you joining us, we are busting out our lab coats and once again diving into the periodic table of medicine.
Oh, that was a great little, like, happy little theme song. I love that. So, Josh, just to refresh people's memories, what other periodic elements have we, what have we borrowed from chemistry and talked about so far?
Depending on what order we air these in,
sure.
I believe we've also discussed fluorine. Okay. And maybe argon.
Oh, yes.
And even iodine. But today, we're going to do something a little bit lighter.
Yes.
And the episode will be a gas.
It will. Although the subject can get heavy from time to time.
And we'll be talking about the periodic table of medicines, helium. It is a light, odorless, tasteless, and colorless noble gas with a strong safety profile and multiple applications as I read its Tinder bio. It does not support combustion.
Weird, right? I mean, people think about usually like hydrogen and helium, you know, if you light it, that it'll whoom, but actually helium burns quite cold.
And it's unique in that its boiling point and melting points are the lowest among the elements, negative 458 Fahrenheit or negative 272 Celsius. It is the second most abundant element in the universe. And yet, despite that, most of the helium on Earth is a byproduct of radioactive decay of uranium or thorium. And has to be extracted during natural gas production. So it's a byproduct of other natural gases we're extracting.
Yeah, we've got tons and tons and tons of helium in this solar system. The problem is that 99.999999% of it is trapped in the sun.
Let's get into our historical. We're going to have to go real hard on the chemistry, at least initially. But I promise it will work its way up to medicine by the end.
Yeah, go hard, Josh.
So let's grab our Wayback Machine and guess it up.
Yeah. Oh, well, at one time we were talking about hydrogen fuel cells to, you know, power our cars. It hasn't become as ubiquitous as we thought it would be here in 2023. But yeah, in this case, we'll use, you know, a fuel other than helium because it's actually not a terribly good, you know, fuel.
So we're going back to the War of 1870 when over 2.5 million people are under siege in Paris. Oh. And during this time, all entrances and exits to the city are closed. There's an army outside the gates. And the Prussian army, that's Prussians with a P, offered just a single person in all of Paris free passage to leave the city, an astronomer.
Oh, okay.
Jules Janssen was the name.
Okay.
And astronomy's the game.
Janssen, what's up with, what's up with Janssen?
He wanted to see a solar eclipse in Algeria, and we'll get to why in a moment. And the Germans actually put science above the fray of politics and told him, that's fine. You are welcome to leave to go watch the eclipse.
Wow. Okay.
And Jules Janssen immediately turned around and said, screw you. I go where I want. I don't respect your authority. So I'm going to leave anyway. And the Germans are like, no, but you can. We will let you leave.
Okay. So what did he do? Something wacky and spectacular?
Yeah, so the German said, sure, you know, just ride out the front gates and you'll be fine. And Jansen said, no, I'm leaving through the air. So he informed the Germans he would take to the air and soar over the siege in a hot air balloon, which is very French.
It is. And for 1870, like, perfectly insane. But there had been, you know, some thoughts of lighter there and aircraft and things like that. And, you know, but this wasn't a common thing that you're like, oh, I'm going to take off in a.
So we have to go. We have to briefly go a little bit further back into this story before we return to Jansen's balloon flight over the Prussian army.
Sure. Okay.
2 years earlier, August 18th, 1868, Jansen was looking at the sun, you know, with the proper equipment.
Yeah.
And he saw something extraordinary. You know, he had his spectroscope, which lets you see the different wavelengths of light that come from the sun. And each color has its own corresponding wavelength. And he saw a bright yellow line whose wavelength didn't match with any known element that came off the sun. It came closest to the pattern made by sodium, but it was still distinct enough that he knew it wasn't sodium. That's about as simple as I can make the chemistry aspect of it.
And sure.
As a result, it meant that Jansen had discovered a new element never before seen on Earth.
Yeah, I can explain a little bit as sunlight goes through a rainbow, right? And it, you know, it refracts through raindrops and things like that. You see the full spectrum of light, right? Well, it turns out that, you know, individual elements have patterns that can be seen in the visible spectrum when you use something called a diffraction grid, or in this case, a spectroscope, going all the way from, you know, Roy G. Biv and little individual spectral lines that look like almost like a barcode. And that it's very odd when you're taking a look at the light, you know, coming from the sun, and all of a sudden there's something that just should not be there. This is where, you know, like the heart of scientific curiosity comes from.
So Jansen immediately sent word of all of this to the Academy of Sciences right after the eclipse.
L'Académie!
He was nearly too late because another scientist almost scooped him, an English scientist by the name of Lockyer.
Okay.
And Lockyer went to a chemist to kind of verify his work, a chemist named Edward Franklin, to try and reproduce this wavelength pattern they had seen. So Franklin thought, well, maybe this is just hydrogen under extreme temperature and pressure, but they weren't able to recreate it. Now, Franklin, ever the practical chemist and a little bit cautious because of all the newly discovered elements that were showing up as the technology of these spectroscopes improved, thought that this was basically going to be another flash in the pan. It wasn't going to be a real element, and he didn't want to attach his name to it. Like, no Franklininium. So,
okay. So he thought this was a wild goose chase.
Yeah. Yeah, he's just like, you know, this is probably just going to be an element we already know about presenting in a new way. He did not want his name associated with this imaginary element, even though Lockyer, his partner, went public, like going, hey, guys, we found something brand new, never seen on Earth before. Okay. And Franklin's like, you know what, just call it helium after the Greek name for the sun.
Helios, yeah.
And other astronomers also began to raise objections. So they couldn't deny the existence of the bright yellow line. People could see it, but they kept rejecting the idea that it came from a new element. And, you know, others like Franklin argued, no, this is just an element we already know that's behaving strangely because it's in the plasma. So helium from the beginning was controversial.
Okay.
Now, back to 1870. Jansen, who had first discovered it, needed to kind of shore up his claim, and it's a lot easier to observe the lines of the spectrum coming off the sun when the sun is not in the way. So during an eclipse.
Yeah. you're trying to see the sun without the sun blinding you.
Yeah. So yeah. that was why Jansen wanted to get to, you know, this eclipse in Algeria. But what about the siege of Paris? Well, Otto von Bismarck had cut all of the supply lines in and out of Paris, even the telegraph line, which meant none of the rest of the world knew that Paris was under siege. So with no way to escape the city and no way to rally support, the French government began sending people up in hot air balloons. Most carried a couple passengers, a few had sacks of mail, one had a cage of passenger pigeons for, you know, return messages, reply all.
Yeah. Yeah, homing pigeons that would basically, they always fly home, which was Paris in this case. But it was kind of a wonderful way at the time to get around this because there was no air warfare at this time. So if you got to a certain height on a balloon, there's really no gun or anything like that that could actually like hit you.
Yeah, but also, as we had not yet discovered helium, as that's what this story is about, what do you think was filling those balloons?
I'm presuming they were doing, well, if they managed to get hydrogen is also lighter than air, but it's really scary, or you could just do hot air.
It was filled with gas intended for Paris's street lamps.
Street lamps? Methane?
Yep.
Oh dear. Oh God. They were flying up on like a straight up bomb.
Yep.
Oh so, God. Okay.
Now, okay. Now remember, we had an English and a French scientist who were both kind of discussing who had both potentially independently found this brand new element. So in the spirit of fair play, the English scientist Lockyer had actually brokered an agreement of safe passage for Jansen to leave the city. He went to the Germans and said, listen, I know you're waging war on Paris, but would you mind letting this one guy out for science? And and the Germans were like, yeah, that's fine.
Yeah.
We don't know why, like whether Bismarck was like a secret astronomy buff or he's like, no, these are cheap, easy points with the international community. Sure. What harm could the astronomer do? Whatever. So Jansen went up in one of these massive balloons.
Okay.
That the Germans did in fact try to shoot down, but he managed to get high enough above the city and through cloud cover so they couldn't shoot him. They made it to Algeria to see this eclipse.
Oh, so he floated down.
Well, see, they were worried he might be a spy, which is why all the balloons were being shot at. And in fact, he was a spy. He was spying.
Oh,
he was also doing science. It was a two birds with one stone kind of deal. So he got over the German lines, landed, gave the report of the conditions in Paris, and then said, okay, my job's done. I'm off to Algeria to science. And then he got there. And the skies were overcast, so he couldn't see the eclipse.
Oh,
anyway.
Oh, okay. Poor guy. All right.
Eventually, they did go on to show that helium was a product, an entirely new element. It was a product of the radioactive decay of radium, and this put it in its relation to the other elements on the periodic table. So that's our brief history of helium, which is just wild when you think about it.
That's so good. Yeah, there was quite a bit of proofs and everything that, you know, Jansen and others had to go through in order to prove that this was a real element. And as you said, Josh, here on Earth, a lot of the time we get it because they are, you know, essentially atoms that come off of nuclear fission when you know, you have a radioactive element and it's throwing off the, you know, particles in order to decay. The sun and a bunch of other stars is actually where a lot of helium is made initially. And that's through the opposite way. It's through fusion. You smash a couple of hydrogen atoms together and you take the next step up, you get to helium. Which is where most of the universe's helium is kind of tucked away, but we can't get to that.
So now that we know where helium comes from, let's talk about its medical uses. Now, there's one that kind of immediately comes to mind. I would say for most people not in the medical field. Who uses helium and how, Santosh, if you had to guess?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, you and I have grown up with helium. Yeah, in the circus.
Down at the old balloon factory.
Yeah, exactly. When we visited the circus and the fair and, I want a balloon, Mom. And, birthday parties and all that kind of thing. And Skippy the Clown would fill up balloons for you and make little doggies.
Outside of children's balloons.
Heliox. You use an air mixture so that you can dive deeper without causing barotrauma to your lungs.
So in 1926, researchers Sayers and Yant found that helium-oxygen mixtures could be safely and comfortably inhaled by humans without ill effects.
Yeah.
A mere decade later, researcher Barak was the first to propose using this mixture as a therapeutic gas. So since the reason for that is that a helium oxygen mixture has a weight that is a third less than normal air. It's air mild.
Yeah. Now, we can't utilize it, which is a big problem, as in, we need oxygen very specifically in order for us to live. So it's not a substitute.
Well, mixed with oxygen, it's one third lighter than normal air.
Oh, gotcha. Which is predominantly nitrogen. Got it. Okay.
Because it's so much lighter than normal air, the original therapeutic use was to give to patients with upper airway obstruction and asthma exacerbation.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
So, separate from the asthmatics who were being pumped full of this heliox mixture, this was deemed to be especially beneficial to deep sea divers, as it would decrease the formation of nitrogen bubbles and reduce the risk of decompression illness or the bends. And so it got the name Heliox for helium and oxygen. In another classic case of scientists naming things.
So, Josh, in pediatrics, we actually do use Heliox quite a bit. The therapeutic application of Heliox in terms of adding a helium-oxygen mixture to a person's ventilatory circuit when you're trying to, get them to oxygenate and ventilate better, and, they have bad lung disease and they're intubated and they're on a machine. We sometimes do use a Heliox mixture because of the lesser density of the helium, you get laminar airflow rather than turbulent airflow. So the oxygen delivery and the carbon dioxide waste should be smoother. Hasn't been proven. But
okay, so helium doesn't react with body tissues.
Right, okay.
It is insoluble in body fluids.
Yes, correct.
Because it has such low density, there's less airway resistance.
There you go. Yeah. So that's the laminar flow. Yeah.
Yeah. So it decreases the work of breathing in people who have increased airway resistance and therefore is used in things like asthma, post-extubation, that kind of stridor crew, bronchiolitis, and COPD. It's also occasionally used in an ICU setting for acute respiratory distress syndrome or ARDS.
Okay, gotcha. So it's not just in pediatric pulmonology. You use it too in adults.
I have to say, it's not something I routinely see. It doesn't seem to be in every hospital everywhere, but it is something that can be used, and that was the original therapeutic design.
Gotcha.
During severe asthma exacerbations, albuterol mixed with Heliox does lead to a more significant improvement in lung values, which we measure with something called spirometry, when compared with just albuterol and oxygen. You use it more for respiratory syncytial virus in kids.
Yes, if they get very sick and you get bronchiolitis, which is a very pediatric phenomenon. The physiology is a lot like asthma. You get bronchospasm and the airways close up and become very narrowed. So in, you know, at times you need to intubate them and provide ventilatory support. And in those cases, sometimes using Heliox rather than, you know, a normal oxygen mixture can help, you know, get oxygen to them quicker. So, yes.
So I just told you it doesn't react with body tissues. So let's get this one out of the way nice and early. Why does helium change your voice if it doesn't react with the body tissues?
Huh. That I'm not so sure. I don't know that I know the chemistry, you know, behind that.
It's not chemistry. It's physics.
Okay.
It's less dense than air. So okay. Sound waves travel through it faster. When sound waves speed up, they stretch out, and the stretched out waves don't really fit in your voice box, so your vocal tract can't resonate and amplify those tones. So instead, your vocal cords start vibrating very quickly, okay. And they emit a higher squeaky sound.
Oh, very nice. Okay. Gotcha. So it's really just the density of the air and how the sound waves move through it. And then likewise, how quick your vocal folds can vibrate. Wild.
Right. And that's why the effect will only last as long as there's helium around your vocal cords. And you only get a couple seconds of talking like this before, before regular air kind of washes it out and goes back to your normal voice.
Yeah.
So lungs are probably the best known target of helium, but okay. Let's look at some of the others that have been studied, and we're starting to look at what helium does to your brain.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Now, I'll put it out there immediately. If you do go for like the, you know, the breathing in the helium trick, and you do it a few too many times, you are going to displace, you know, the oxygen that you actually need. So, you know, you might end up, you know, either slightly or completely suffocating if you go to that. So ultimately, because you said, you know, helium doesn't interact with our tissues at all, you can't form ATP. You run out of energy, and you know it can be a killer if you do it that way. But I'm thinking you're going for a smaller dose.
So yeah, it can make you high because of the lack of oxygen, which of course leads to the idea that, well, maybe it can be an anesthetic.
Oh, okay.
And unfortunately, it can't.
Yeah.
So unlike, say, for example, xenon, uh-huh. which is a noble gas, not the leader of Scientology.
Okay. Okay. Yes. Yeah.
It's a Scientology joke for those of you playing along.
Zing. Absolutely.
Unlike xenon, helium has no anesthetic properties. So given the higher pressures predicted to be anesthetic, helium just increases the minimum alveolar concentration and will end up producing convulsions or seizures. So it is a non-immobilizer, a gas that doesn't induce anesthesia, but may still have other biological effects. And again, that all comes down to the fact that it doesn't react with body tissues. That's the main takeaway from a lot of these stories we're going to be going into.
Okay, cool. All right.
Now, the reason I mentioned xenon, aside from the chance to make a Scientology joke, is that yes. Xenon has neuroprotective properties that prompted researchers to look into other noble gases. So they Ooh. Did Heliox treatment or preconditioning in the nervous system and compared the difference with hyperoxygen, meaning you give a lot more oxygen than the body normally takes in, compared okay. to giving Heliox during people who had had strokes, which is ischemia or low blood flow, and subsequent reperfusion or reintroduction of that blood flow into the brain. And they gotcha. Found that giving Heliox was actually superior to giving hyper levels of oxygen in infarct volume reduction. So essentially, if you're having a stroke and you have a tank of oxygen and a tank of helium or heliox, again, not helium directly, heliox,
in your
ambulance, you will preserve more brain tissue by giving the heliox.
Yeah, it's a weird thing to think about. After you have deprived a tissue of oxygen, and you're thinking that in order for it to get better quicker, you'd want to deliver back as much oxygen as possible to allow for the tissue to recover and start working again. But that's kind of a scary thing. When you deprive a tissue of oxygen, a lot of the time, the blood vessel will actually kind of constrict so as to not allow more tissue to die upstream of the blood supply. And then when you reintroduce the oxygen, you flood the area back with blood, and the oxygen in the blood is actually toxic to that tissue, and you can accelerate damage. Therefore, altering the mixture and delivering a kind of like a reasonable amount of oxygen is actually probably superior to a large amount of oxygen straight up, especially to the lungs, heart, and brain.
And again, because of this less dense volume, it's going to travel faster, it's going to improve the flow, and it'll reperfuse the tissues more effectively. Now, right. In another study, rats who were treated with helium below body temperature, who then had induced strokes, they were subjected to an occlusion of the middle cerebral artery. Mm-hmm. When they were pre-treated with helium, they had smaller infarct sizes. Their strokes were smaller. They had faster recovery. Interestingly, in rats who were treated with helium at
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Room temperature, 33 uh-huh. degrees Celsius. Right. This neuroprotective effect vanished. So the only way that helium is actually effective in decreasing the damage from stroke is if it's hypothermic.
Yeah, we do know that hypothermia in and of itself is protective in ischemia events, both for the heart and the brain. And we still use cooling for recovery of patients who've gotten strokes and heart attacks. So we know that that's a big component of it, but it's kind of neat to see that the effects are additive like that.
Yeah, so again, you're in your ambulance, you have reached for this container of heliox because you're like, all right, well, this will be more effective than pure oxygen. But then you have to look at the temperature, because that high thermal conductivity of helium compared to air means you're only going to get that protective effect if it's less than 33 degrees Celsius. It can't be room temperature helium. It's got to be cold.
God, oh, that is very cold. Okay. All right. So hopefully the person is sedated or something like that, because that degree of cooling can be painful.
Now, a different group of researchers wanted to study this even further. So they did an in vitro study of Schwann cells, schwing, from and Schwann cells are some of the conducting cells surrounding the nerves. And
yeah,
they
insulate the wire so that our neuroimpulses are smoother.
and they isolated these cells from the sciatic nerves of 4 to 5 day old rats. The sciatic nerve is one of the largest nerves in your body.
Oh, yes. Huge. The one that run basically from your spine down the back of your leg. And if it gets impinged or trapped, that's the one that hurts like hell and causes sciatica.
It's the fiber optic cable of your body walking around. Yeah. And they found that irradiating these Schwann cells from the sciatic nerve with a helium neon laser actually caused the cells to proliferate and start rebuilding in a dose-dependent manner. Meaning the longer you train this helium neon laser on these cells, the faster they would build out new pathways of nerve conduction.
Okay, gotcha. Very cool.
So helium protects from stroke, and it may be because it promotes proliferation of new neurons or new conducting sheaths for neurons, which means there may be some applications for restoring neurons post-injury. So there may one day be a way for helium to help treat stroke patients in terms of therapy.
Oh, beautiful. Okay, so still on the horizon, not part of our normal repertoire as yet.
No, still in the lab, still with rats, but it does have some very clear effects on the nerves that we are starting to work out the mechanisms for.
Nice. Okay.
Now, very often in people who've had a stroke, it's because they have low blood flow, which normally is a heart-based problem. It's rare that strokes are caused by an issue beginning directly in the brain.
Yeah, the most common occluded areas are actually down in the neck. You certainly can have the cerebral arteries clog up, and you know, the further the smaller the blood vessel, the smaller the stroke. And so those small little watershed strokes can happen. But the ones that we think about as big, devastating strokes that, you know, you talk about in a medical textbook are the blood vessels clogging up either in your neck or you already have some, you know, occlusion. And then you have something like, a heart attack or a lung problem where you drop the blood flow or the oxygenation even more.
So let's look at what helium can do for the heart. Does it make your heart light and carefree?
That would be lovely. Although, given that, you know, if you're sucking down a lot of helium, you can't have oxygen. So maybe it sort of kind of hurts you, kills you. I don't know.
So we've seen studies that show that heart tissue can be protected against low blood flow by subjecting it to shorter protected ischemic episodes before the real one. So like you train your heart to have a heart attack by giving it little stressors that simulate heart attacks. Don't try this at home. This is all done in lab settings.
Yeah.
This is known as early preconditioning. You can also do post-conditioning after ischemia. Yeah. And in a study on rabbits, giving them 3 5-minute cycles of a mixture of air that's 70% helium, neon, and argon. So no oxygen. So you're giving them ischemic flow, but you're making a large part of that pre-training from helium. And it reduced the size of the heart attacks that they then subsequently gave the rabbits.
Gotcha. Okay.
So again, if you're walking around just huffing on helium all day and you're about to have a heart attack, there may be a smaller heart attack than you would have had otherwise, than the non-balloon huffing friends.
Gotcha. Okay. Let's hope that that never turns into like a necessity, but okay.
So in case you're wondering, has any of this been tested on people? A study of 17 men subjected to 15 minutes of exercise on an ergometer were breathing ambient air or heliox. Okay. It was shown that the heliox improved exercise tolerance. It reduced lactate, which is something that our bodies build up when we're exercising. It's a breakdown product or a toxin that you can think of compared to ambient air. So the cardio protection was actually due to signaling kinases and inhibiting mitochondria from kind of losing their ATP.
Oh, that's kind of nice. Okay.
So the fancy word for this is mitochondrial uncoupling.
Gotcha. Yeah. So you're hitting a little bit of an off switch on the production of the power that the powerhouse makes, which is adenosine triphosphate or ATP.
Yeah. So you're turning off the thermostat for a bit. So all of those are some of the effects in the body. Now, external effects in the body is surgery, right? Right. Sure. Now, surgeons, if you've ever had a colonoscopy or an endoscopy or quite a lot of surgical procedures, like a laparoscopy, carbon dioxide is usually the go-to gas to insufflate the cavity, meaning you have to pump up enough air so you can see what you're operating on. Because most of the time, if you were to just cut somebody open, everything's stacked on top of one another. It's really difficult to get to one organ versus another. So you have to put in a little bit of air to separate the things so you can see what you're working with, especially when you're making a very narrow incision like a laparoscopic appendectomy or a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, taking out the appendix or gallbladder.
Yeah. You know, our body's not meant to have big gaps in it. So that's usually not a good thing. So, you know, if you were to just put a scope inside of the peritoneal cavity, inside of your abdomen, everything would be all squished together. So you've got to fill it up. Why not use, like you've taught us, Josh, an inert gas that reacts minimally with human tissues in order to, to do that inflation. And then after you're done with the procedure, you take it out. And, you know, the helium comes out, it escapes into the air, and it's gone.
So surgeons are starting to explore the use of helium instead of carbon dioxide because it prevents respiratory acidosis in conditions that cause retention of carbon dioxide. And that's because carbon dioxide is already kind of stored in sites in the body and released at the conclusion, and it's absorbed into your system. So it backs up and creates acid. So it forms an acidosis, meaning you breathe more quickly. You hyperventilate to blow that acid off, or you retain acid. You're holding on to it if you're a COPD person, and that can make you a little more confused and cause a carbon dioxide narcosis. Like you're out of it because you have so much carbon dioxide and acidosis built up.
Yeah. So even though it is a quote unquote natural part of respiration, and you'd think it would be somewhat helpful, using an inert gas like a noble gas is probably the much better idea in this case, such that when the gas is introduced, it doesn't cause any harm. And then when you take your instruments out and you vent the gas, it just gets out of the body instead of getting absorbed into tissues and interfering.
Yeah, so that non-reactivity of helium is really something that's impressive. And, you know, don't forget, it's a noble gas. It's all the way over on the far right of the far right of the periodic table with the rest of the noble gases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, far and away, the single largest use of helium in medicine is as a cryogen in MRI machines.
Yep, now, fancy word for coolant.
Just think Demolition Man.
Yeah.
As we so often do.
Yeah. All right, well, we're not freezing anybody, people.
Well, we're freezing the machines that look at the bodies of people. So when helium is in its liquid form, its temperature is over 450 degrees below zero, which is essential to keep the superconducting magnets in MRIs cool enough to operate. So here's how MRI machines work.
Okay.
The body's water molecules become aligned when they're in contact with the machine's magnetic field. When those atoms are aligned, they give off radio frequency signals from vibrations that send images of the body's internal structure in slices based on where we set the cameras and the electric field up. And the way this happens is with these powerful superconducting magnets that are put into action using helium. And the reason we need that superconducting magnet is so there's no electrical resistance, because otherwise your MRI machine would heat up too fast from that resistance and explode, which would be bad.
So superconductors, as far as we know, and we may find a room temperature superconductor sometime, probably in our lifetimes, Josh, you and I. But for right now, in order to get anything to superconduct and then to cause, you know, cast that magnetic field, you need to bring the temperature way, way down. Does everybody remember, listeners, raise your hands if you remember that melting and what was it, Josh? Condensation, condensing and melting temperature that Dr. Josh told you about at the beginning of the episode, down by like close to -300 degrees Celsius, like really cold. That's how cold you want things in order to superconduct.
And if you don't get them that cold, then you don't have a magnetic field in something that large and you're not getting an MRI.
Yep. And or you are getting an MRI and burns.
Yeah, and an exploding machine.
Yeah, an exploding machine.
So these are all a bunch of really great uses for helium. None of which involve children's balloons.
Yeah. Or talking funny.
Now, you also may have heard we're running out of helium. Remember how we said there's a finite amount on Earth?
Yeah. This was a problem actually about, I'd say maybe like 5 to 10 years ago. We had a real fear of, oh my gosh, we're going to run really short on helium for use in medical devices.
So let's talk about why this would be a problem. Like some of you who watch on TikTok may have learned that, oh, we may lose within our lifetimes certain kinds of cheeses because the fungi and molds that produce them are dying off. Well, similarly, we may lose a huge medical technology, probably not within our lifetimes, though, as we run low on helium. And why would losing MRIs be such a big deal? Well, bone infections cannot be seen by x-rays for about the first 21 days, and therefore they lag behind MRIs. So if you have an infection in the bone like osteomyelitis, and you have to wait 21 days before it even shows up on an x-ray, you get a worse outcome. And that's not even getting into like the entire attack on the whole specialty of neurology and what they would do if they can't diagnose strokes with MRIs.
Yes. And We like to think, and I like to think, that a lot of these entities we can diagnose clinically and use other modalities, but, you know, there are ambiguous cases out there where the use of an MRI really, really helps us pin down a diagnosis and then get treatment started ASAP. So, yes, especially in this day and age, it is something we really rely upon to have intact. We could live without it, but you wouldn't want to.
And how much could we live without it compared to some of our other countries around the world if we're traveling? Well, in 2021, 38 million MRI exams were done in the USA.
Wow.
The highest number of MRI exams anywhere in the world was done in Japan, with about 55 MRI machines for every million Japanese people. That's how many just units there are. The U.S. on average has 40 MRI machines for every million people.
And by the way, that's not like evenly distributed across our country.
Oh, no, not even remotely.
Yeah, it depends on where you live and how rich you are, etc.
Well, it's where do you find a million people? Like, you know,
oh, sure.
If you have a million people in New York, then there will be one MRI machine. But if it takes, you know, a million people in all of Iowa, then...
Yes. No, that's true. But that also means that those million people are spread out over a much larger land area, and they have to travel a long way if they need imaging.
Yeah. So yeah. Japan has 55 MRIs for every million in their population. The U.S. has 40 MRIs for every million population. Germany, gotcha. Germany, Korea, and Greece have around 30 MRIs per million. And coming in at the lowest, France only has 15 MRIs per million of population.
Gotcha. Okay.
So France is really not, for people who discovered helium, they're like, no, we're good. We don't
we don't use it as much. But it does, there are differences in practice in terms of how often this type of advanced imaging modality is used for diagnosis. There are those of us who, A, rely on other modalities, and B, also, you know, rely more on clinical exam and history and physical rather than going for something like an MR. So, and then of course there is always the matter of money. Can you afford, you know, an MRI? Can you afford to get it and maintain it?
I'm so glad you asked that, Santosh. You brought that up. So since most of the energy used in liquefying helium is done to cool, helium has to be cooled down to, you know, 4 degrees Kelvin, which makes it very expensive compared to other elements. So, for example, liquid nitrogen can cost as low as 15 cents per liter, while liquid helium's price can range anywhere from $3.50 to $50 per liter.
Wow. Okay.
Now,
and
how
I'm
often
guessing
are you,
there's way more than a liter, huh? In a
well, yeah. How often are you topping off these tanks? Like, what's the rate at which you are burning through your helium? Well, thanks to advances in refrigeration technology, at this point, I'd say around the year 2000, most helium or MRI machines are using less than 0.03 liters per hour, which means helium would need to be refilled once every 3 to 4 years.
Oh, okay. Not bad.
Okay. So where are we getting this helium? Well, let's get back to the present day. As of 2022, shutdowns at gas production centers in the U.S. and Qatar and fires at a Russian facility disrupted the world's supply of helium, which means that academic research labs that need helium to do spectroscopy or superconducting quantum devices or nuclear magnetic resonance were all forced to shut down. Essentially, we said science can't use helium because we don't have enough. It has to be sent to where it's truly needed, medicine and children's balloons.
The first one is real. The second one's a bit facetious.
Labs had to pay a 30% premium on existing world prices of helium.
Wow.
So the world's major helium reserves used to be in the U.S., as well as Qatar and Algeria, while the top suppliers to the rest of the world are the U.S. and Russia. Helium in the U.S. is found primarily in the Texas Panhandle and Kansas. We used to have a U.S. helium reserve located deep underground Amarillo, Texas, and we stockpiled a ton of helium in anticipation of needing it for all sorts of things. And then the U.S. was like, oh, shit, we have too much helium and we're not really using it. So let's start selling it off to other countries around the world. It was the reserve was slated to be shut down by 2021. And it, in fact, was. So we have sold off all our excess reserve helium.
That and, quickly?
Well, between 2000 and 2015, we sold off the vast majority of it. By 2021, we closed down the United States helium reserve. And it had provided about 30% of the world's supply until that time.
The world's supply. Okay.
Also, you might have recalled I mentioned Russia earlier. So Russia's in a bit of a tiff with Ukraine at the moment, as of the recording of
as
this
of
episode.
This recording, yes. Yeah, bit of a tiff, sure. Okay.
And that is exacerbating the shortage of helium because they have reduced capabilities for extraction. Nobody's trading with them. So we're seeing one of the worst helium shortages since 2006. Ah, yes, the great 2006 helium shortage. So...
All right.
So we are looking for ways to preserve our ability to continue getting MRIs. We're looking for helium-free alternatives.
Okay.
Conventional scanners require about 0.5% helium for just 3 scans, whereas a new machine introduced by Philips during the shortage, since 2018, 600 of these units have been installed. And they do helium-free MRI scans, which is saving over 1 million liters of helium. So the Philips system uses about 0.02% of the capacity of a machine per day, which means you're dropping your helium by about 1% every month.
Okay, that's significant. Mm-hmm. And I'm guessing, you know, the more you use it, the more helium you consume, but the quote-unquote savings would be greater.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about numbers. So this is the new machine, Philips. You're going through about 1% of your helium each month.
So meaning that like you start with a tank, and this is the percentage of the tank that you're burning off with each scan.
Compared to some of the more common scanners, like the Toshiba or the Siemens, which use around 4% or sometimes even as much as 6% of the helium per month. And it's not like you can go from 100 all the way down to empty like it's your gas tank. You have to refill the MRI machine before the helium level drops below 65%, or the MRI machine will no longer work. It will break, it will overheat, it will potentially explode, and you're not going to have a good time.
Yeah, okay. So it's not like you can keep, you know, like a near empty tank. You actually have to have some pressure from the helium supply at all times.
Or you won't be able to get those magnets cool enough and they'll overheat.
Got it.
Using, you know, we've run through our reserves. We are using about 4% per month. The vast majority around the world, not just in the US, is being used for medical purposes, primarily in MRI machines, which use about 30% of the world's helium. The amount going into children's balloons, for all that we're joking about it, if you took away all balloons from all children and never used helium in a balloon again, that would add maybe 2-4% back to the world supply. So you'd get an extra month or two of MRIs at best.
Okay. All right. So not too much of a dent.
Not a huge dent, but angry scientists are petitioning Congress to ban the use of helium in balloons. So, you know, good luck with that. estimates vary as to how much helium the world has left and how long it'll last. The best guess is that with helium recycling, we have somewhere between 100 and 200 years before we run out of all the helium on Earth. And that does factor in this new pocket that was just found in Tanzania.
Gotcha. And more than likely, and by the way, you know, that there's helium there and wonderful and all that kind of a thing, but let's please preserve the beauty and the, you know, the wonder of Tanzania and not rip it up just for a single resource, please, people, first of all. And then second of all, as you said, the need pushed us to innovate, and Philips came up with a better system that uses less helium. There's a fair chance that we'll keep going in this direction and perhaps move away entirely from helium as a cooling measure, and or, you know, keep chipping away at the need for the amount of helium that we need, such that the reserves that we have stretch further and further.
So we started and ended this journey with balloons, and look at all the places that gas worked its way in.
Yeah, in absolutely. Between. Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, we are trying to conserve the world's helium, I guess don't overbuy balloons, but also enjoy yourself. Go have fun.
I will say to our colleagues in medicine around the world, do get really good at your clinical exam, history taking, physical exam. You know, these will often point
because
you...
in 100 years.
No. It's honestly and truly, there's a lot that you can learn from there that you don't necessarily need an MR in order to reveal what's going on. And then, you know, build up your guidelines and everything so that utilization of a precious resource like an MRI, which is not just helium, but it's also time and effort and expertise by a radiologist. You know, use it as you need. Don't go hounds just because you have like a brand new 3 Tesla machine.
That's it for this week and this periodic element. I think we'll make it through a lot more of these than our plagues. Are we up to 80 yet? We must be getting close. But
well, no, but this is our periodic table. This is different from our 80 plagues.
So we have a whole... Yeah, we're starting to set the table. We're working our way around. But that's it for this week. As always, we love to hear your comments, questions, and feedback.
Woo.
If you'd like to support us spiritually, emotionally, or financially, links to do that are in the show notes, along with links for further reading. We are on all the social media, Spotify, Facebook, TikTok, Instagram. If people are clustering online, we are there. Our theme music is composed by Rachel Leisure. The show is produced by me with a lot of help from Dr. Santosh and friends. And until next time, as always, keep a song in your heart, soap on your hands, a shot in your arm, a spin on your globe, a balloon at hand, just in case. Never know when it might come in handy.
Yeah, and you may need to float away from some Prussians.
Or to check out an eclipse, or even just to try and pre-train yourself to prevent stroke or heart attack damage.
Yeah.
I wonder now, if you like start feeling chest pain and you see a happy little child holding a balloon, do you rip it away from them
and start
huffing while you call 911?
No. Please take your... That is so funny. No. Take your rescue. Take your aspirin. And what's the little tablet that you take for angina, Josh, that you keep in your pocket?
Nitroglycerin.
Nitroglycerin, and call 911. Don't leave the child alone, please.
But, you know, take a balloon with you, like the one of those get well soon balloons.
That's fair. Yeah.
And when you've done all of those things, happy travels.
Bye, everybody.